So we're going to read from Luke chapter 22, verse 63. Not verse 3 for the vision people. Is that right? I just noticed the order of service was wrong. Okay, so Luke chapter 22, verses 63 to chapter 23, verse 25. And that could be found on page 1059 of the Bibles. That's Luke chapter 22, beginning at verse 63. Perfect. Well done. Sorry about that. The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, "Prophesy, who hit you?" And they said many other insulting things to him. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. "If you are the Messiah," they said, "tell us." Jesus answered, "If I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I asked you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God." They all asked, "Are you then the Son of God?" He replied, "You say that I am." Then they said, "Why do we need any more testimony? We have heard it from his own lips." Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Messiah, a king." So Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "You have said so," Jesus replied. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests in the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirs up people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here." On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform a sign of some sort. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. That day Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who is inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us, as you can see. He has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him." But the whole crowd shouted, "Away with this man! Release Barabbas to us!" Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again, but they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" For the third time he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has this man committed? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore I will have him punished and then release him." But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Lord God, as we look at your word again this evening, please speak to our hearts and our minds. And please speak to our hearts as we realise once again what it cost you, how painfully you died to save our skins. Amen. I expect you all saw in the news, I suppose it was a couple of months ago now, about the man called Andrew Malkinson. He was the guy that was convicted in 2003 of rape. And in spite of countless police interviews, trial by jury, appeals, reviews of his case, he was still found guilty. But then it came to the Court of Appeal in July of this year, 20 years after his first arrest and being chucked in prison, and he managed to prove beyond a shadow of doubt that he was innocent of the charge for which he'd been locked away. And after he'd been released from the court, he went out and he stood on the court steps and said, "Today we told this court that I was innocent, and finally they listened. But I've been innocent all along for each of those 20 years that came before yesterday. Nothing any police officer, court or commission said about me since 2003 changed that reality. I've always been innocent." Ring any bells? I can hardly begin to imagine that man's feelings of frustration and anger and helplessness, or indeed the feelings of the police and the judges and the juries who were all involved in the miscarriages of justice. But today's passage, of course, is about Jesus and those who put him through so much worse than that man had been through. And here's the irony of it all. Jesus was the only man who ever was truly innocent of all sins for all of his life. Nothing anybody could say would change that reality. Jesus has always been innocent. And yet he went through all those trials and torture and sadistic execution as, by sheer irony, never actually being helpless. He was the one in charge. He did it without complaining or losing his temper or fighting back. He did it without protesting. But he did it purposefully in order that that Old Testament prophecy would be fulfilled. He did it so that the law would be fulfilled. He did it so that the law would then be abolished. And he died to make you and me holy and to redeem us from death. Christ knew just what he was doing, and so he went along with it. He went where you and I should have been, so that we are able to go where he is now. That's why he did it. And this really was the greatest masterclass of all time in what Graham Kendrick's song calls meekness and majesty. But what I thought we'd do this evening just is to look at a different angle about this story, and to look at it from the point of view of some of the other key players in the story. So let's start off with the soldiery, and I'm going to make an assumption that even though the people who went to arrest him may not have been the people who were mocking him at the beginning of our reading, well, I expect they were in the same barracks, and I bet they knew all about it. I bet they'd been talking. See, do you remember John's account of the arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane? That said, told us that Judas, who was going to betray Jesus, he came into the garden, and he was guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief of priests and the Pharisees. And they were carrying torches and lanterns and weapons. And Jesus, knowing what was going to happen to him, went out and said to them, "What is it you want?"
"Jesus of Nazareth," they replied.
"I am he," Jesus said. And Judas the traitor was standing there with them. Now get this, when Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and they fell to the ground. They knew who he was, all right. They knew just who he was. This wasn't an ordinary run-of-the-mill prisoner. And as if to prove that, of course, Peter then went up with his sword and struck one of the soldiers and chopped his ear off. And Jesus said, none of that, none of that. Stop that fighting. And he healed the man's wound. So the soldiers saw with their own eyes that this man, Jesus, was entirely passive. And they saw for themselves an example of his miracle powers of healing. They clearly believed that he was worthy of worship, not of arrest. But then these poor guys, they were soldiers and they were under orders and they would probably have been executed themselves if they didn't do what they were told. So they arrested him. And maybe, just maybe, they felt a sense of guilt and injustice. And that's why by the time they got back to the barracks, they reacted in the way that they did. Maybe it was, if we sort of go mocking and beating Jesus, it's some sort of self-justification. Oh, we were wrong. He was bad after all. Take that, you. Yeah, that makes me feel better. I'm beginning to shift the blame off myself and onto Jesus. Officially, he hadn't even yet been found guilty. But still, they blindfolded him and bullied him by teasing. They were numbing their consciences by pretending that the blame was all his and not theirs. And in case you think I'm just pushing it too far, let me suggest that that's something which is all too horribly human. And I ask this of myself, how often am I guilty of acting like those soldiers? Things aren't going my way, and I feel a bit out of control. And so who do I blame? Well, Jesus, of course. And I mock him that if he was really in control, he'd do something about it. He'd get me out of this. You see, it's so much easier to blame Jesus than it is to face up to the realities of our own actions and reactions. And that's question number one for tonight. Do you ever do that? Do you ever do that? Well, then we go on to the council of the elders of the people and both the chief priests and the teachers of the law. And John sums up their problem quite succinctly in chapter 11 of his gospel. People knew that Jesus had brought his friend Lazarus back from the dead. And people were becoming increasingly convinced that Jesus really is the Son of God. And simply because Jesus was walking about alive, well, that was an incredibly effective witness. So the Pharisees thought it would be a good idea to bump off Lazarus, get rid of the evidence. You see, the problem was that if Jesus gathered too many followers, he might get the attention of the Romans, and he might start to undermine the Jewish relationship with the occupying forces. What are we accomplishing, the leaders had asked. Here's this man performing many signs, and if we let him go on like this, everybody will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away our temple and our nation. They're scared of losing their own place of importance. So they forgot all about Lazarus. Let him carry on walking about. I know what, let's bump off Jesus. Let's go to the root of the problem and get rid of him. Now, you've all heard of the most important man around at the time, the most important Jew around at the time. He was Annas, the chief of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was the supreme council and the tribunal of the Jews at the time, and had got religious, civil and criminal jurisdiction. Annas was a big head, high honcho Jew. And he was very wealthy and he was very powerful. His family controlled what went on in the temple. And his family, his sons and his son-in-law, Caiaphas, had held the office of high priest. But I wonder if you know this. This is just another little fact, that one of the sort of perks of his position was that he had the monopoly on controlling the buying and the selling of animals for sacrifice. Now, guess what had happened a day or two before the arrest? Of course, Jesus had gone into the temple
And they cleared the temple and said, "This is terrible. Stop selling these animals for profit. This isn't godly stuff. Get rid of it." And he cleared the temple. The message that came from the temple was perfectly simple. Don't mess with Annas and his crew or they'll sort you out. And you know what? Jesus was no longer flavour of the month with them. These thugs started the process of sorting him out. But what could they accuse him of? Well, we're told, if we look at the passage, that they accused him of blasphemy. Blasphemy, that's saying he was the Son of God. But you know what? He'd spent months telling even the demons to keep quiet about his identity. Now, there's an irony for you. Even the devil and the devil's angels knew who Jesus was. But he was accused of blasphemy for what others were saying. And they accused him of claiming to be king of the Jews. But he never actually said that. It was others who recognised that he was the Messiah. And they said he tried to get a do away with the Sabbath. But actually, he'd simply pointed out God's priorities, that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And they said he'd started riots and uprising against Caesar. Now, actually, remember what his actual words were, the words that we've got written in the Bible. His words were, "Give to Caesar that which belongs to Caesar, and to God what belongs to him." Jesus was and is many things. But frankly, as an efficient and dangerous rabble-rouser, he's a failure. He really wasn't rabble-rousing. But the funny thing is, you see, that this same set of circumstances has been repeated time and time and time again, all the way down the centuries, in every country, in every time, including our own. Thank you. You see, Jesus' reputation suffers. He suffers at the hands of his enemies. He suffers at the hands of the people who shouldn't be his enemies. He suffers at the hands of the rich and the powerful people called Cardinal this or Archbishop that or Metropolitan what's his name or Churchwarden Mrs. Extremely Important or Treasurer I say what will be spent round here. All drawn together in their desire to hang on to their cosy jobs, their cosy reputations, their self-important positions in society. And hang Jesus. Well, literally, hang Jesus. They cling on to their long-held theological dogma. And they resent having it challenged by Jesus. And so instead of listening to him, they try to silence him and make out it's him at fault. And the Sanhedrin's motto seems to have been, why mess up on a good story by bringing fact into it? And that's been the mark of those who would speak against Christ right down the centuries, right up to the present day. But that never happens round here, does it? That never happens in our church. It never happens in my heart or in your heart, does it? Or does it? So now let's get on to the really important head high honchos, to Pilate and Herod. Pontius Pilate, I've got to admit that I wrote the sentence and I scrubbed it out and I'm now going to say it anyway. I've always felt a bit sorry for Pontius Pilate. There, I've said it. You see, Pontius Pilate was faced with an incredible dilemma. On the one hand, the last thing he wanted or could allow to happen on his watch was to have a riot on his hands. Whilst on the other, he was being asked to pass the death penalty on a man that he patently thought was innocent. This guy was in a real quandary. And then he found a way out. Well, so he thought. You see, Jesus came from Galilee. And by coincidence, the king of Galilee, that's Herod, had come to Jerusalem. Maybe he'd come for the Passover time. And Herod had got the right, indeed the duty, to try one of his subjects. And so Pilate packed Jesus off to Herod for trial. Now let's be clear, this man was Herod Antipas, and Herod Antipas had heard about Jesus because he used to go to the sermons preached by John the Baptist. He'd heard all about Jesus. And he'd also would have grown up knowing that his dad, that's Herod the Great, had been so concerned when he'd heard about baby Jesus being born in Bethlehem that he'd ordered a mass slaughter of all baby boys in order to safeguard his own power and authority. Now, I don't know whether Herod Jr. made now the connection in his mind between the birth of the baby and this prisoner. I don't know, but we do know that he was intrigued by him. Because Luke tells us, when Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased because for a long time he'd been wanting to see him. And from what he'd heard about him, he'd hoped to see him perform a sign of some sort. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. And neither did Jesus take up Herod's invitation to perform a miracle in order to get himself out of trouble. 3 years earlier, you'll remember, right at the start of Jesus' public ministry, the devil had tempted Jesus to save himself out there in the desert. And later on this same day, one of the thieves who was hanging on a cross next door to Jesus' cross, he would tempt Jesus and say, "Come on, if you're the Son of God, save yourself." But here's the thing, Jesus never, ever, ever resorted to showbiz tricks to prove his own identity. Sure, he performed miracles, he still does today. But they're reserved for demonstrating God's nature. They're reserved for showing God's healing, his love, his compassion, his hatred of death, and his mastery over creation. They're not there to just entertain the unbelieving. And so Herod did what all politicians do when they're losing an argument. He mocked and he made fun of Jesus. He belittled him. Because by belittling someone, you see, you can make yourself look quite good by contrast. And then he got rid of the problem by delegating it back to Pilate. And once again, that begs a question. Hey, if we'd been around at that time in those shoes, would we have tried to run away from what we know is right, but which presents difficulties to us? Do we ever try and do that by passing the buck onto other people and pretending it's not our problem? Do we ever do that? Do we ever pass the buck instead of manning up to our own problems? Well, so back to Pilate, who we read is now mates with Herod, and so needing to consolidate his position as a strong man. Pilate actually had quite a humble beginning. His family, only two or three generations back, had been freed slaves. And he'd worked himself up as a cavalry soldier, and was now a general. But in the face of royalty like Herod, you know, he was a bit intimidated. So he really didn't want to let himself down in front of Herod. He'd got his own career to think about. But he still didn't really want to kill off Jesus. So he told the crowds that both he and Herod found Jesus not guilty of anything. So here's the compromise. Look, it's brutal, guys, but you're a brutal nation. So here's what we'll do. We'll flog him. That'll nearly kill him anyway. And then we'll release him. And at that, the crowd went wild. Kill him! Give us Barabbas! Barabbas had been thrown in prison for starting a riot in the city, and he was in prison for murder. Pilate still wanted to let Jesus go, and so he spoke out again. But they kept on shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And so he tried for a third time. He said, "For what crime? I found nothing that he's done deserving of death. I'm going to flog him. Come on. I'm going to warn him to watch his step, and then I'll let him go." But they kept at it, this shouting mob, demanding that he be crucified. And finally they shouted him down, and Pilate caved in and gave them what they wanted. And then, as we all know, he washed his hands of it all. He wanted nothing more to do with this injustice he felt he'd been forced to perpetrate, and he hoped that this public gesture of washing his hands might absolve him of responsibility in history's eyes. What would you have done if you were a member of that crowd? What would you have done if you'd have been a member of that crowd? Would you have gone along and been part of the mob? I think I would. I'm not sure I've got the courage to stand up against an angry mob. Stand up and be different. How about you? And how about Pilate? You see, Pilate was guilty. He may have washed his hands, but he was guilty. He was guilty of not using his position in society in order to do right. He was guilty of not putting his foot down when firmness was needed. He'd had a bad press from Christians down the ages. Why? He's had a bad press because of his moral cowardice in doing what he knew to be wrong and not doing what he knew to be right. Pilate was guilty of doing what he knew to be wrong and not doing what he knew to be right. How's your conscience with not doing right and doing things you know are wrong for all the wrong reasons? How's your conscience? Mine's got some work to do, I tell you. And at the end of all of this, I ended up by asking myself, who am I most like in this story? Am I most like the soldiers who subdued their own guilty consciences by mocking Jesus? Am I like the priests who would do anything to hang on to their power and position? Anything, including telling lies about the Messiah? Or am I like Herod, who looked to Jesus to provide proof to obviate the need for faith? Or am I like Pilate, who tried to avoid uncomfortable decisions by passing them to others and then saying, "Well, it wasn't my fault"? What about you? Who are you like in this story?